disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest with my help.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 been war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s, write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned, for every cop car that ain't been turned.
Welcome to This Is America, June 10th, 2021. On this episode, first we bring you an interview with Lauren Swain, the partner of anarchist prisoner Sean Swain, who currently has launched a campaign in order to help them hopefully transition out of prison later this summer. We discuss Swain's case and his amazing life, his journey to anarchist politics, and the oppression he has faced as a politicized prisoner. For ways to support Sean, check out his Instagram account linked in our show notes. We then switch to our discussion, where we tackle the attempt by the Republicans to solidify their base increasingly within the far right and what this means for the wider political terrain. All this and more, but first, let's get to the news. This week, thousands of people responded to a call put out several months ago to converge against the Line 3 pipeline and blockade the construction site. Police and DHS agents responded with arrests and flying helicopters low to the ground in an effort to frighten water protectors and stir up dust storms around those who locked down the construction equipment. According to reporters with Unicorn Riot on the ground, some of the lockdowns put in place by water protectors impacted construction significantly, and in one instance lasted for over 30 hours. Be sure to check out their extensive coverage linked in our show notes. According to a press release on the action, in Minnesota's largest ever anti-pipeline mobilization, water protectors Monday morning halted construction of Enbridge's Line 3 toxic tar sands pipeline. Over 1,000 people marched with indigenous leaders to the headwaters of the Mississippi River for a treaty ceremony at the site where the pipeline is supposed to cross. Further south, over 500 indigenous people and their allies shut down an active Line 3 pump station in a massive direct action in solidarity with the GNU Collective, an indigenous women Two-Spirit-led frontline land defense organization. These actions are part of the Treaty People Gathering, a mass mobilization of more than 2,000 folks planned by indigenous-led groups, communities of faith, and environmental climate justice organizations. This is the beginning of a summer of resistance. At daybreak, hundreds of land defenders marched to the two inlets Line 3 pump station. Some climbed ladders or locked themselves to equipment, while others blockaded the entrance. To donate to the bail fund, see our show notes for a link. Actions in solidarity with Palestine continue as Block the Boat mobilizations have taken place at various ports across the U.S. and in Canada over the past week. Mass pickets, which have been honored by union port workers of the ILWU who have refused to cross the lines, at the Port of Oakland and in so-called Canada have been successful in stopping the unloading of Israeli goods from ZIM ships. According to one report, this is only one facet of a larger labor struggle of solidarity. In May, members of the South African Transport and Allied Workers Union in Durban, South Africa, responded to a call from the Palestinian General Federation of Trade Unions and refused to offload cargo from a ZIM ship. Dock workers in Italy withheld their service to unload a shipment of arms going to Israel. And on May 25th, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union North California District Council also expressed its support of the Palestinians in a written statement. Not to be outdone, a communique posted to Abolition Media Worldwide also took credit for an action in solidarity with Palestine. The communique reads, "The brutal bombardment of Gaza, the mass eviction of Palestinians in East Jerusalem, the attacks on mosques, these can only be described as acts of ethnic cleansing and extermination. Last week, in an act of revolutionary solidarity with autonomous Palestinian resistance, we started a fire at the Pratt & Whitney engine facility in Orange County, California, completely destroying a fleet van and damaging the exterior of the building. For us, revolutionary solidarity can't mean words or symbolic gestures. It means putting our entire bodies into the struggle and causing material damage to the war machine. Pratt & Whitney is a division of Raytheon Technologies, the fourth largest arms dealer in the world. Pratt & Whitney have deep ties to the Israeli defense industry. In 2015, Pratt & Whitney signed a 15-year contract with the Israeli Ministry of Defense in support of the Israeli Air Force, designed to provide 100% daily propulsion readiness for the entire Israeli fleet of F-15s and F-16 aircraft. Pratt & Whitney also supplies the engines used in the Israeli Air Force's entire fleet of F-16 fighter jets. These are the same fighter jets now being used to rain down all hell on Gaza. As we approach the one-year anniversary of the burning of the Third Precinct in Minneapolis following the police lynching of George Floyd, we can't forget the role that the arms dealers such as Raytheon played in the militarization of law enforcement. Raytheon supplies police departments across the country with surveillance technology and training software. We know that all liberation is tied together. The Israeli settler state is enlivened by the same racism and colonial ambitions that the United States is emboldened by as well. The same multinational corporations arming the IDF to crush Palestinian resistance are also arming law enforcement agencies in the U.S. to brutalize black and brown communities. From the alleys of Gaza City to mountains of Kurdistan to the streets of Minneapolis, solidarity with all who struggle against colonialism and state power, anarchist cells of abolitionist fire. In strike news, over 3,000 auto workers at the Volvo New River Valley plant in Dublin, Virginia are back on the picket lines following their second mass rejection of a sellout contract, which forced the union to reauthorize the resumption of the strike. Meanwhile, in Alabama, a strike by over 1,000 United Mine workers fighting against a tax on their pay and benefits by Warrior Met Coal continues to heat up. Last week, video surfaced of a boss hitting a striking miner with their truck. According to one report, the recent attack is only the latest in a string of assaults against strikers, who have been, quote, hit by cars 3 times in the past 3 days while on the picket line. In Minneapolis, on the morning of June 8th, the city attempted another eviction of George Floyd Square. However, community members swiftly put back barricades. According to the Associated Press, city crews returned Tuesday to a Minneapolis intersection where a memorial of George Floyd was assembled after his death last year and worked to reopen it to traffic by removing barricades, only to have activists barricade the area once again. As soon as workers left the area on Tuesday, activists moved back in, again blocking traffic with parked cars, trash cans, traffic signs, and other items in a repeat of last Thursday's scene. As the Star Tribune noted, members of the Agape Movement, a community group hired by the city to provide security in lieu of police, and protest organizers argued over the wooden pallets and concrete barricades remaining on the west side of the square. As soon as workers were finished, protesters began parking cars and piling pallets in the streets once again. A new zine has also been created, mapping the various nonprofits and community organizations actively working as a force for counterinsurgency on behalf of the police in the city of Minneapolis. You can check it, linked in our show notes. And now for some upcoming events. On June 11th is the International Day of Solidarity with Marius Mason and other long-term anarchist prisoners. Philadelphia, there's a barbecue and movie fundraiser. In Detroit, a noise demonstration. In Cincinnati, Ohio, there's a film screening and a benefit. And in Portland, Oregon, there's a letter-writing event. On June 12th, there is also a letter-writing and book packaging for prisoners event in Chicago. From June 12th through the 13th, there is the Philly Skillshare Convergence. On June 18th, there is a counter-protest against the Proud Boys in Oregon City, Oregon. From June 26th through July 1st, there is an Earth First Summer Gathering in so-called Minnesota. And also looking forward, on August 25th through September 9th, there is a call for abolitionist actions in support of the Shut Them Down demonstrations. Finally, from November 12th through the 14th, there is a call to protest the White Nationalists American Renaissance Conference in Burns, Tennessee. Also, if you enjoy It's Going Down, this revolutionary autonomous media resource in times of crisis, please go to itsgoingdown.org/shop. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop. You can sign up to donate monthly through the site or on Bitcoin. You can also tell a friend about us, listen to us on the radio, follow us on social media, share our podcast with a friend, and be sure to check out the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. If you like this show, there's probably lots more waiting for you there. That's going to do it for us. As always, enjoy the interviews and the discussion. We will see you soon.
My name is Lauren Swain. I identify as a genderqueer individual. I am a master's student at Eastern Michigan University in the Gender and Women's Studies program, and I currently reside in what is so-called Canada, which originally was Turtle Island.
Okay, cool. So today we're going to be talking about Sean Swain's case and what's possibly, maybe, hopefully happening with that is that he may be getting out soon. And we're also going to be talking about just Sean's life and just kind of how we got there. So do you want to take us back to the beginning and just tell us about Sean to begin with?
Sean's case started in 1991 when he was dating a ex-partner. And so this ex-partner had an abusive ex-partner. And at the time, Sean's ex-partner didn't want their ex-partner to see their kids just because of, struggling with addiction and abuse. The partner called up the house and told Sean's partner, I'm coming to get the kids. And she said no. And then he got irate and said he was going to come over and kill Sean. Sean's partner and the kids left, and Sean said he had hopped in the shower and got out and was doing his hair. And, he heard a knock at the door, and so he went to see who it was, and it was Andy, which is the ex-partner, boot opened the door, and he had a gun. So, like any rational person, Sean defended himself, so he stabbed Andy, and he died. And then it went to trial, and, the short version is Sean was convicted of aggravated murder, but there's a lot of, political kind of bullshit surrounding that, because Andy's relative was she sat on the something about the Republican Party, I think Sean said, or she had some pull in the trial or some pull in the judicial system or something like that. So of course, if your nephew was killed, you would want them behind bars forever.
Talk a little bit more about just how that dynamic played out. There was somebody that was connected to a judge, as you were saying, and that impacted the case, or it's widely believed that impacted the case.
Sure. Yeah. So Andy actually had an aunt, I believe, or a relative that was kind of seated in the judicial system in Ohio, or part of the Republican Party, I think. As they heard Andy was killed by Sean, so when Sean went to trial, they obviously had some pulls as the head of the political party. So Sean got, 20 to life, and he's been away for 30 years.
There was no self-defense argument that just fell flat. What did they argue? That he was some cold-blooded murderer that planned to do this, or?
For sure. So what had happened was at the crime scene, Sean thoroughly believes evidence was concealed by the police, as they, quote, didn't find a gun at the crime scene, saying that Andy didn't have a gun and Sean just stabbed Andy out of malice. But also at the time of the stabbing, Ohio had no Castle Doctrine, which is the self-defense law. So if anybody, comes on your property, you have the right to defend yourself. That didn't exist at the time when Sean was convicted, so he couldn't use the Castle Doctrine in trial to substantiate why he defended himself against Andy.
Gotcha. So he's sentenced to 30 years in prison, which is a lot, obviously, for
so much.
Yeah, and also I've read or heard that he was a labor organizer or something at some point in his life. Was that before he went in, or?
Yeah, I believe it was before he went in. Sean was a union organizer. I don't know much about that part of his life, but I do know he was a labor and union organizer.
Do you know much about his early time in prison? I feel like most people have probably started to hear about Sean maybe starting 10, 15 years ago. How did he kind of become the person that we know today? How did he become the Swainiac?
The Swainiac. He wasn't an anarchist going into prison, and I know he met some folks on the outside when he started to, I think he started to write some folks on the outside, and he met, I believe, his friend Ben, and Ben was an identifying anarchist and started to write to Sean about, anarchist philosophy, and Sean started to look into that and, continued to teach himself about anarchist philosophies and anarchist ideologies, and then eventually he grew into the lovely Swiniak we know today.
His time inside is, you know, you could write a whole book about that as well. I don't know if you want to, how much you can get into, but I know that Sean has been kind of at the epicenter of a lot of stuff going on inside as well, and has had, you know, numerous back and forths with the authorities.
For sure. So one of the biggest things Sean has been through in prison is he actually faced domestic torture while he was in Ohio, and Ohio officials plotted to murder Sean, and he does have proof of that. So in 2018, I believe he was, in 2018, he was subjected to domestic torture because of his political ideologies and due to the JPay article he had wrote. So JPay is, for folks who don't know, JPay is an email system in which you can, you know, contact your relatives in prison, but it costs you money. And so Sean actually discovered that JPay was a front for a collections agency collecting data on people who are using it. So he exposed that. And because the owner of JPay at the time was Annette Chambers Smith, who is now the head of the parole board, he got in some hot water. So Sean was thrown into the hole and was subjected to, like, bright lights, starvation, just domestic torture. I think he said he lost about 70 pounds while he was in the hole. And at one point, before he was illegally renditioned to Virginia, some inmates had overheard guards plotting to transfer Sean to Lucasville, where they were going to plot to murder him and frame it as a suicide or, like, a hanging. But they, the prisoners luckily, became like whistleblowers, and then, they panicked. And so Sean was illegally renditioned to Virginia from Ohio.
So how did you, end up connecting with Sean? If you want to get into that?
Yeah, sure. It's kind of a crazy story, kind of, maybe, I don't know. So I started listening to the Final Straw Radio in about like 2014 when, I had bought a Pat the Bunny album, and it just had a lot of like radical, you know, podcasts and books to like read and listen to inside like the album. And I discovered like the Final Straw was on the inside of the album. So I started like listening to it, and I started to like listen to Sean, and I was already like radicalized myself. I was already involved in like a lot of organizing around like intersectional feminism and like pro-choice and, you know, ending sexualized violence. So I was already radicalized, when I discovered Sean, and I really connected with what he was saying, you know, during his segments. And so I'd always wanted to write to him, but I was always like too scared because I was like, well, I'm going to sound stupid. I'm going to sound dumb. So I never did. And then finally in 2020, I finally like grew up, and I wrote him a letter thinking I wouldn't get anything back because I knew like hundreds of people wrote to Sean, you know, day in and day out. And he's always got like a stack of mail. But I got like something back, and he even drew a cartoon of me. Because he had his friends look me up online and send him a picture of me, and it's one of my roller derby pictures, and he was like, haven't you wondered how I ever got that? I had him look you up online. I was like, oh, God, you're so creepy. But yeah, so I wrote to Sean in 2020, and then we started writing, eventually started calling, and then video chatting, and our relationship kind of, like, flourished from there. You know, I connected with Sean immediately, and I knew it was going to be a hard road, but I definitely knew like I wanted him in my life.
How do you think Sean's journey has impacted him, I guess, in prison? I mean, like, how have you seen him make possibly change over the years?
I can speak to like 2020, 2021, excuse me, because I've been in his life. And so like when we talk about it, Sean said, you know, like before, he didn't really care if he like got out or didn't, because he felt like he didn't really have anything like on the outside, you know, like he didn't have like, I don't know. He just felt like if he got out, he got out. And if he didn't, he didn't. And then we kind of like connected, and he said he kind of like, you know, quote, grew up really fast because he like, he wants to get out and he wants to start a life with me. And like, that's what he wants. And he feels like he has something to get out to and to like, you know, a fresh start, so to speak, on the outside. So we're hoping this time, you know, he gets out and we're able to, you know, like, live our lives and start a family and be normal people.
How do you feel, like, interacting with, like, The Final Straw and other anarchist projects? Like, what's that, how has that been for him? Is that, like, a big part of his life? How does he kind of view that aspect of what he does?
For sure. So The Final Straw has been, like, a really big, and other, obviously, anarchist news has been, like, a really big part of his life because, you know, it was an outlet for him. Like, The Final Straw allowed him to, like, express himself in ways that, like, maybe, like, a lot of prisoners didn't understand, you know, because Sean is really intelligent and thinks really radically. And although, you know, like, he likes his friends that are, like, you know, he's situated with, a lot of them, you know, don't really fully comprehend anarchism. So it was a good way for Sean to, like, A, get his, you know, thoughts out, but B, to connect with people. And I think that was really important for Sean, is that, like, through these, like, anarchist groups and podcasts, he was able to connect with people on the outside. And I really think that that helped him get through, you know, difficult times, and that really helped him, like, you know, escape his reality.
For sure. He has a book out now, right?
Yes, he does have a book out. He has two coming out. You can look for them in the next couple months. He has Opposing Torture as well as Ohio coming out. Super, super exciting.
And then he has another one that's already out right now, like The Revolt of the Circus Animals or something like that.
Yes, Last Act of the Circus Animals.
Okay,
yes.
Close.
Close, very, very close.
Awesome. Yeah, I definitely encourage people to check all those out. So let's switch gears and let's talk about his parole coming up. And this has happened before, right? He's been out for parole several times. And tell us about the process and what's happened in the past.
Oh, boy. So I don't know a lot that's happened in the past, but what Sean has told me is that, like, there's a lot more, I guess, gears turning now than there ever were. I don't think Sean felt as though, you know, like, he had support on the outside and he appreciates that. But I just feel like a lot of people now are, like, coming together, and, like, it's kind of, like, becoming the perfect storm, in that, like, there's a lot of pressure, I find, like, on the prison industrial complex, especially in America. And there's a spotlight shining down on them. And, you know, I've done my best to kind of, like, you know, just, like, I guess, like, throw a wrench in the system, and just, like, kind of, I've done my best to kind of, like, get Sean's story out there. So a lot has, like, changed now, in that we have, like, multiple support teams for Sean. As well, we found a lawyer that is willing to take Sean's case on, which is really, really big, because last time he didn't have representation, which is, I think, one reason why the Ohio Parole Board was able to give him 5 years, because he didn't have anyone to, you know, litigate that or do lawyer things inside of the parole. So we're really, really excited to start working with the lawyer.
So there's a call right now to support Sean. It's multifaceted. Talk about that. What's in it? What are the asks, and how can people support Sean? What can they do right now?
Yeah, for sure. So we have an Instagram going. You can find us at Swaniac, 1969, and there is a link in the bio to, you know, just fill out your information. It's a pre-written letter, and that letter will go towards supporting Sean's parole. So we are currently collecting letters to present to the Ohio Parole Board to indicate that Sean does have a lot of, like, community support and backing for his parole. We are as well raising funds for his lawyer fees, as lawyers are expensive. So we are doing, you know, Swaniac buttons and Swaniac signs and Swaniac stickers. So for every $20, you know, a person donates, we will send you a Swaniac package, which is really exciting. And you can as well find the info on where to donate on Instagram as well.
Awesome. So we will have that linked in the show notes. Definitely encourage people to take part. Also remember that June 11th is coming up, and people are encouraged to write letters and offer support for long-term anarchist prisoners. Anything else you want to say? Anything else we didn't cover, perhaps?
I really appreciate you giving me time to talk, and I really appreciate all of your support for Sean. And he appreciates it too.
For sure. Anything else you want to say about Sean? I mean, obviously you all are excited about the future. Does he have any other plans? Is he going to continue to write or do radio when he gets out? Is that something that he's thinking about?
He's going to continue to write, and he's thinking about obviously continuing on the Final Straws. Those two things are, you know, a part of his life. I'm going to try and keep him, you know, out of trouble and out of prison. So, you know.
Another week, lots going on, lots of disconcerting news. There was a conference that was held in Arizona about a week ago where it was largely like a QAnon get together. Former General Michael Flynn was there and was asked essentially, why can't there be a military style dictatorship coup like there was recently in Myanmar? And Flynn responded by like, yeah, there should be. And this really kind of lines up with a lot of discussion we heard from a lot of segments on the far right. Just on the It's Going Down Twitter, we shared a short video clip that the people at One People's Project shared. And it was somebody discussing, it was like somebody that's like a white nationalist discussing what the Boogaloo movement was about. And they said that the Boogaloo movement was a growing consensus of people on the right that understand that basically hegemony cannot be controlled anymore through the electoral process, and that because of demographic shifts, whether from immigration or political changes, they can no longer win elections through the Republican Party, and therefore a guerrilla war must be launched in order to take control of the state and, you know, create a new kind of society or government, which I think is just interesting. Really, because, I mean, we've said this before in this program, but there's all these different segments of the far right, whether it's, you know, racialist or it's militia groups. And they all kind of are different in some ways, but they all kind of share this similar idea that, like, this coming clash is quickly approaching. And basically there needs to be some sort of, like, you know, outside electoral action that takes place that, like, re-preserves, you know, the real America. And whether or not they state it, it seems implicitly clear that this is, you know, based on, like, preserving some sort of racial and political hegemony with only certain segments of the population in control, which, I mean, is very frightening. I mean, when you have people that are like, you know, that conference that we were talking about, the QAnon one, I mean, there were, like, elected Republican officials that attended that. You had people like, you know, former, you know, General Michael Flynn. I mean, you know, as out there as he is, I mean, he's still, like, a former general. He still has connections. I mean, the fact that people feel comfortable taking these positions and being associated with these groups, I feel like really says something. And the fact that all of these different segments of the right are kind of coming to this, like, Turner Diaries-esque conclusion that, like, soon there will be this need to, like, launch this, like, civil war, essentially, is frightening in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I want to start a bit in talking about this with a discussion of a mythology, right? So we've talked a lot about the history of the modern far right on this show, and spent a lot of time drawing that back to Reaganism and the embrace of the religious right, the embrace of conspiracy theories under Gingrich. But there's this narrative that has sort of grown up, probably starting a few years ago, and has really kind of taken on some inertia this week, which is starting to construct a history of this sort of shift into overt authoritarianism, with this claim that what we're seeing now is radically different than the Tea Party. And on some level, that's true, right? On some level, the Tea Party's concerns were very different, right? They're mostly about taxes and the Affordable Care Act and stuff like that. But the Tea Party identified as libertarian, largely. But if we really want to look at what was forming the foundations of that, I think we can, it's sort of instructive, right? We can kind of get an illustration of what's happening here. So it has been often commented, especially, by people who engage in things like critical race theory and stuff like that, that the embrace of economic libertarianism amongst the right wing in the United States was always meant to be a way of getting the federal government out of their process of imposing segregation. And we can see that in the fact that, quote, libertarianism really built up as a political philosophy in the United States following the Civil Rights Act. Before that, there weren't really a lot of people that were arguing in that direction. In fact, big government and kind of mass politics were sort of the words of the day in the 1950s. But you really started seeing this revival again of this notion of states' rights with people like Strom Thurmond. And Strom Thurmond was saying, well, the government can't stop, you know, Mississippi and South Carolina from, you know, being having an entire legal regime of discrimination and apartheid. The whole reason that they were making that argument for, quote, states' rights, which is a mirror of some of the arguments that were made around the Civil War, is purely to preserve segregation. And so what we saw with something like the Tea Party was we saw the language of libertarianism, but it was being used to sort of engage in cultural warfare, right? It wasn't so much about shrinking government, right? Because at the same time the right wing talked about shrinking government, they also talked about things like outlawing abortion, right? So, like, using the violence of the state to impose their moral will on everybody else, right? That is also inherently an authoritarian position. And so what really is happening here is there are kind of two tendencies within that sort of construct, within that framework, that don't function together. The first is a notion of moral absolutism, and the second is a notion of small government. They can't function both at the same time. And what really is going on here is Republicans for decades at this point have taken this position in which if they cannot win a national office, then they will win all the state offices. And if they win the state offices, then they can impose their moral will on people from that position. And we see that with anti-abortion laws being passed all over the U.S. right now. Those are all coming sort of on the heels of the Republican Party losing power federally, and, you know, reshaping the Supreme Court. And so we can already see, that tension exists. And in reality, the tension sort of functions around the same goal. So the goal of imposing moral absolutism, or the goal of imposing a structure of racial apartheid, functions along the lines of how one gains power at what level. That has always been what is core to Republican Party discourse since the Civil Rights Act, has always been, how can we maintain enough power to keep this structure of white supremacy in place? Right. And to be fair, plenty of people in the Democratic Party were also trying to do the same thing. Some still might be, but especially back in the Dixiecrat era in the 60s and 70s into the 80s, they were trying to do the same thing. And so it's not unique to Republicans, but at the same time, I want to be very clear. This drive towards authoritarianism is also not new. This is not something that arose with QAnon. It's not something that arose with Trumpism. Just like everything else, you know, I think there's a tendency, especially amongst sort of the liberal and progressive press, to talk about what happened and what is happening, on the level of an anomaly, right? They want to talk about it constantly as being anomalous, that all of a sudden there's former generals talking about military coups. They want to talk about Donald Trump as an anomaly, as something which is not, you know, a logical outcome of 400 years of white supremacy. They want to talk about it as an anomaly, as something which we can just get rid of, and then everything will just return back to normal, right? This is the whole Biden campaign. We're just going to get rid of the anomaly. Everything will return to normal, right? And on some degree, that is sort of what we've seen, right? The Biden administration is very boring, and they do everything very bureaucratically, and that is kind of normal, right? But it ignores a very basic fact, which is that all of these political tendencies, whether we're talking about anarchists, whether we're talking about, you know, Michael Flynn, whether we're talking about the DSA, it doesn't matter. All of these political tendencies have a history. None of them just emerge out of nothingness, right? And what's really important for us right now, as we're starting to work through this, you know, the beginnings of a conversation about you know, Michael Flynn's overt endorsement of a military dictatorship, I think it's really important first to dispel that myth. This is not new. This is not something which is just emerged in the Republican Party. It's something which has become more overt. It's become louder. You would never have heard a Republican in the past say that they were pro-military coup. But at the same time, those same people were also deeply authoritarian, right? They're politicians. And in the fact that they're politicians, they are authoritarians. I want to be very clear about that. Every single utterance of a politician is a police order, right? Every single thing a politician does is grounded in the notion of using state violence to impose their will on us. Every politician is an authoritarian. But within the Republican Party, what they've done is they have sort of paid lip service to this idea of small government in service of an authoritarian agenda, right? Which feels like a paradox. But if we really look at it from the perspective of rhetoric and goals, it makes a lot of sense how they've been proceeding in this direction. But there's been a shift, because what's happened is, on the right wing, the idea that they could win office and use that political power to impose their will on us is sort of starting to evaporate. We're watching numerous manifestations of this play itself out, right? The first is, you know, as you mentioned earlier, there is an increasing discussion on the right wing about how electoralism is not going to function for them anymore. They, you know, it's the right wing. So they attribute demographics purely to race, right? And this is where, like, right wingers start talking about the great replacement theory and stuff like that. But in reality, there is a kernel to the idea that the Republican Party is sort of demographically disappearing. That's not all just because of race, though, right? We're seeing kind of realignments of American politics in relation to race. It does have a lot to do with age. And so if you look at Republican voter totals by age group, what you see over time is that Republican voters skew older and older and older and older and older. And this happens election cycle after election cycle after election cycle. And they keep getting older. Your average Republican voter now is over the age of 45, right? And what that means, you know, when you combine that with other polls that have been done, which have shown things like the millennial generation, right, which I'm very much a part of, has not gotten more conservative, right? Like, there's always this trope. I'm sure you heard it from your parents at some point or another, but that, oh, you know, you'll get older. You'll grow out of it. It's just a phase. You'll get more conservative as you get older, right? That was true for the boomer generation. That is what happened. And boomers became more selfish. They became more self-interested. They became more capitalistic. And as a result, they became more conservative. The millennial generation has gone the opposite direction. It has gotten more anti-capitalist. It has gotten more radical over time. If we look at the Zoomers, that is even more the case. And so it's not just because America is becoming less white. It's because America is becoming less old. The baby boomer generation is dying. And that is the core of the Republican Party, is baby boomers. And so that concern isn't based on nothing, right? I want to be really clear about that. It's not based on nothing. There is an impetus to this. It's not just a conspiracy that Republicans will not win elections. They won't very soon. And that's increasingly becoming a reality. So what we're seeing is we're seeing sort of three things happen here in response to that, which are all part and parcel of the same sort of drive towards using the state to impose morality. The first is this kind of push towards having these kind of really egregious over-the-top limitations on voter participation. So things like, you're not allowed to have vote drop boxes in some states now. Why? Well, there's no evidence that those ever contribute to fraud, but that's the argument, right? That they're going to start saying things like, you know, in Georgia, they're trying to limit the number of hours that that polling stations are open because, well, they know that people in cities stand in line often for a really long time to vote and they just won't be able to.
But criminalizing bringing people pizza or water.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very clear what they're trying to do.
Yeah. There's a discussion about, I forget which state it was, but preventing people from going to polling places with cell phones. So if you're standing in line for 5 hours, not only can you not eat, drink, go to the bathroom, but you have nothing to entertain yourself with. These are all really egregious and really obvious. And what the effect of these are going to be is kind of twofold, right? The first, because a lot of these are going to get overturned in the courts, but the first is it is a mobilizing issue. And we talked last week a lot about how, the Republican Party is now functioning purely as an organization which is attempting to maintain enthusiasm. They're not attempting to grow the voter base anymore. And I'll talk about that in a second. What they are trying to do is they are trying to keep the voter base they have mobilized, right? They're trying to keep them riled up. You can see this on Fox News. They have gone back to kind of the like day-to-day cultural outrage, you know, blah, 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 always keeping the old white folks angry about something. You know, like they've moved back into that, and voting laws have kind of in the recent past been sort of a, you know, political symbol for the right wing, right? And so they're leveraging it that way. The other thing that's going to happen, though, is that is going to change outcomes. Now, in most states in the U.S., in most areas of the United States, outcomes are really obvious, right? Like where I live, we all know the Democrats are going to get elected to everything. There's not even the possibility of something else happening. Even when DSA people run for office, they run as Democrats here. Like there's not even the concept that anything else could happen within electoralism, right? And that's common in most cities, right? Most major cities in the United States. When you get out to really rural areas, it is really obvious that most of the people out there vote Republican. It's incredibly obvious. Where you start to see the bleed over between the two is actually the suburbs. Now, we talked a lot about during the election about how Trump lost the suburbs. And because he lost the suburbs, he lost the election. And that is true to a large extent, right? If you really look at numbers of suburban voters and the way that they changed their political support during the election, and you do the math on that, that is roughly the margins that Trump lost by. So that's not particularly surprising, right, that the suburbs are kind of moving in another direction. But it's in those areas where elections in areas, states which have or even congressional districts which are kind of tight, where elections are close, it's those areas that tend to make or break a difference, right? So what Republicans are doing is they're not really relying on converting any suburbanites again to voting Republican, right? They've gone further into conspiracy, you know, fever swamp land. Again, talk about that in a second. But what they are trying to do, though, is they're trying to eliminate Democratic voters from other areas. So this kind of shift back and forth in the suburbs matters less. It's all math, right? So they're trying to disempower people that are easier to disempower. Because if you disempower them, it's not like they're going to stop voting for you because they already aren't, right? So what they're doing is they're trying to, you know, target people that already are not voting for them. And they're doing that in service of these small slivers of margins, 100 votes here, a couple hundred votes there, 1,000 votes here, that can swing whole, specifically congressional elections, specifically House elections, can get swung by those really small margins. Although we saw that in the presidential election too. They weren't that small. But they were small enough that it's believable that if you were to impose something like this on a statewide level, you'd be able to get 50,000 people or so to not show up, right? Like that's viable. That's believable. So that's happening. And what that's doing is it's actually alienating a lot of people, but that's not a concern for them. Which leads into the second thing, which is the other dynamic that's happening here is that the Republican Party has stopped really trying to gain voters. They haven't been trying to do this for years. We can see this playing itself out very overtly right now. Things like the Arizona audit are wildly unpopular nationally. Things like QAnon are considered, you know, wingnuttery by mostly everybody, right? The idea of military dictatorship is considered completely absurd by the vast majority of Americans. Yet this is what they're running with. And they're running with this because it solidifies and consolidates their voter block, right? So this is the second part of what they're doing is, and this is an outgrowth of a strategy that we've talked a lot about on this show that has been sort of operative in the Republican Party since the mid-90s, which is creating the permanent Republican voter block. And the way that you do that is by isolation, right? The isolation of information sources, the isolation of people, the isolation of political positions, right? The more extreme and out there their political positions become, the more that ascribing to those positions becomes an article of faith. And when it becomes an article of faith, the conflicts that emerge over that become existential, right? And that is a lot of what we're seeing. And that move is very intentional. I mean, you are seeing state Republican Party chair people like Alan West, who's the chair of the Texas Republican Party, went to QCon, which is the conference that happened in Arizona. He was present there. The head of the Texas Republican Party, Kelly Ward, who is the head of the Arizona Republican Party, was at the conference, right? These are people who are leadership in major state Republican parties, not little tiny ones like New York State or something, but huge ones like Texas. That is a shift. And that shift very much indicates that if Alan West is willing to show up at a QAnon conference, Alan West is not attempting to win over voters that are not already voting Republican. That's really, really, really obvious. So that's the second thing that's going on. But the third thing that's happening is this kind of anxiety, which is emerging. One of the manifestations is what you mentioned earlier, right? Neo-Nazis are even more so starting to talk about, you know, the idea of dropping out of electoralism and launching the civil war or whatever they think is going to happen. That's becoming more and more and more prominent as a position, and becoming louder and louder and louder. And you're starting to see that position expand. So you're seeing that position expand in a number of directions. You're seeing that position expand on the level of voting restrictions, right? What's happening in that discourse is actually kind of fascinating because traditionally when Republicans talk about voter ID laws and things like this, what they're saying is that they're trying to prevent illegal votes. Now, the term illegal votes, they just really dove into this term illegal votes really effectively on the QAnon Anonymous podcast very recently, the most recent episode where they were talking about QCon. They also dove into this a bit on the Fever Dreams podcast, which is done by Daily Beast, Will Sommer, people like that. And what's happening is a rhetorical shift, which seems subtle, but is actually really, really important. Prior to now, generally, the way that voter ID laws and stuff were framed was based on the idea of stopping people that are not allowed to vote from voting. Right? Now, of course, there's almost no evidence of that happening in any kind of meaningful or organized way. But that didn't really matter, right? That they had at least an argument which was concurrent to what they were trying to do, which was limit the amount of people that showed up to vote. And they can make the argument that, oh, they were just trying to secure elections. What they're doing now, though, is different because they are still using that rhetoric sometimes. But the other rhetoric that they're using and that they're falling back on is this notion of invalid votes. Now, invalid votes are slightly different in that invalid votes within this narrative are votes which were cast by the voter legally, but that become invalid because of some interpretation of some action that was taken at like a county board of elections or something. So, for example, in Fulton County in Georgia, they had mobile polling stations and lots of people voted at these mobile polling stations. Now, these mobile polling stations are totally legal. They were you know, operated by the board of elections in the county. They really dramatically increased turnout and were probably at least somewhat responsible for Trump losing Georgia. But are entirely legal. And so what the Georgia Republican Party is arguing is that, well, nope, even though there's no reason to say those aren't legal, they're illegal. And because they're illegal, we have to throw all those votes out. And so what they're now saying is people that legally voted, we need to throw their votes out because they voted for the wrong guy, essentially. And if we can't make that argument, then what we're going to do is we're going to manipulate the electoral process so we make sure that people vote for the right guy.
I think as anarchists, a lot of times when we start talking about voting, people start to roll their eyes. Yeah. But I think it's important to realize what they're trying to get out of this is basically to shut whole segments of society out of the voting process so they can just lock down rule. And you couple that you couple that with, you know, the slew of laws that they are trying to pass or they already have passed mm-hmm. against protesting and all this talk of like another civil war. I mean, you know, you're again, like just around, just like when we were talking about a potential coup, you know, last winter. I mean, this is a scary situation. And it's, you know, what are the Democrats doing about this? Are they doing anything at all?
No. I mean, they're throwing a lot of lip service around, right? They're saying, oh, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene shouldn't be in Congress anymore. Or, you know, we need a January 6th commission. Or, you know, like they're throwing out a lot of rhetoric, but they're not doing much about it. They're filing lawsuits and stuff.
Because right now the left position is like, you know, Democrats, you know, in the filibuster or something like that.
Yeah, well, and they're kind of – the Democratic Party is focusing on things they know voters care about, like, you know, passing another COVID relief bill and infrastructure bills and stuff like that, which they know people care about, which are not random political issues, but which are kind of the bread and butter of the Democratic Party, that in some ways – they're going back to a politics that sounds a lot like the New Deal, even though it's not, but it sounds a lot like that. And that is an attempt to actually pull new voters in, right? Like this is the goal here. But what's going on with Republicans, though, and I think that this is the really relevant part about this part of what's happening. What they've essentially done is they've said they start off with the position of we need to secure elections, right? That's not really what they were trying to do, but that's what they were saying. And that at least preserves this idea that elections are the way that sovereignty is decided, right? But what they're moving into now is this position in which the voting process becomes essentially an aesthetic, right? It's the image or performance of liberal democracy, when in reality, we already know what the outcome is going to be, right? That is a lot more like Belarus. And that's really disturbing. I'm not a person who really is super down with elections, right? However, one political party seizing sovereignty permanently is a really upsetting and disturbing situation. Like that's when the prison camps start, right? That's when the dissidents start getting rounded up, right? Like that's actually incredibly dangerous for us, even though it is essentially a conflict over liberal democracy. The outcome of that can become incredibly dangerous for us. If that outcome, you know, results in a single party being able to seize power more or less permanently, that's a really disturbing reality. So then there's another faction of the right wing, which is heading in this direction of civil war, right? And they're getting really, really loud. But on some levels, they're kind of played out, right? You're seeing less and less and less of this rhetoric from people like Michael Flynn, who in the fall were talking about that in that language. You're hearing less and less of this from Steve Bannon, for example. You're hearing a lot more of those people fall into either the first camp, like Bannon is definitely really on this sort of like, we need to fundamentally change the electoral system to guarantee that we win sort of thing. People like Michael Flynn went the other direction, and they're in the, we need a military coup camp. Now, this camp is kind of interesting because, it is something which comes out of QAnon, right? Like the whole idea of the quote, the storm was that the military would step in and seize power and put Trump back in power, round up all the dissidents and the liberals and blah, 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 and shoot them all. That is a vision of military dictatorship and mass execution. That was already at the core of QAnon for quite a while. I mean, I think that that position emerged in about 2019, when it started to become pretty clear that Trump was going to have a hard time getting reelected. That position sort of emerged. But it's taken on this new tone, where it's not so much about the storm, because what's happening in QAnon circles is they're sort of moving away from the language of QAnon while still keeping the exact same position. So they don't talk about the storm anymore. They don't talk about Q-drops really anymore, at least a lot of people. But they do talk about the like cabal of, you know, pedophile elites running the world still, but they just don't talk about that coming from Q-drops, right? Like they're starting to figure out a way to sell that rhetoric to people that are outside of QAnon unsuccessfully, but that's what they're trying to do. So for Michael Flynn to go into this conference and answer a question about Myanmar, affirmatively and say, yeah, that's what should happen. That's one thing, right? Some wingnut guy gets up and says something. The fact that the entire crowd went completely wild about that is actually the more disturbing.
Well, again, that's the fantasy, right? And this is the, you know, this was the fantasy with Trump at, you know, January 6th that again, that he would cross the Rubicon, that, you know, he would call on his people to engage in violence against their enemies. You know, it's, I don't know. It's just, it's so frustrating to see, you know, this same crowd, like get really upset about, you know, somebody getting in a fist fight with them and like them still think this thing where they're like somehow the victims. And, you know, like somebody was mean to me on the internet, therefore I must like, you know, launch a fascist dictatorship after a civil war. I mean, it's just really hard to believe. Like, therefore I need to line you up and all your friends against the wall and kill you. I don't know.
Kind of is hard to believe until we draw this back to the history of the right wing since Reagan. Right. So the idea that there would be a sort of dictatorial regime in America, until very recently, I think for the vast, vast, vast majority of people sounded really ridiculous, but only kind of, right? I think for people on the left, that always sounded a bit absurd unless you were a tanky. But on the right wing, there's always been sort of a hedging about this, right? And I think that this is really important to point out. Keep in mind, right-wing politics as it exists in the U.S. grew out of pro-slavery camps in the sort of lead-up to the Civil War, which were trying to impose a sort of rule of the slave owner. They're trying to impose a regime of slavery. And in the process, they were sort of engaging in ethnic cleansing in Africa in order to sort of support that, right? It was an incredibly disturbing process, but one which is a structure of authoritarian white supremacy. Right. We can't underscore that enough. What was being argued for in the South during the Civil War was a form of authoritarian white supremacy. That is not unique to that camp. And that is not new in America today. Right. We saw a similar phenomena emerge in things like the Tulsa race riots. Right. Which were an act of ethnic cleansing, which is something which is very concurrent to authoritarian white supremacy. Right. And in that instance, very specifically, like there was collaboration between the police and the military and white rioters. That's really well documented at this point. Getting into the 1960s, right? People like George Wallace, people like Barry Goldwater, right? They weren't arguing for some sort of like opening up of the American social space. They were saying we need to seize control of the state so we can impose our vision of a good America, right? That is also what the religious right says. They need power so they can impose their moral vision. That is what the Tea Party was about. That is what Trumpism is about, right? At the end of the day, there's kind of two operative questions in all of that sort of construction of politics, right? And this even includes people like Mitt Romney. I mean, keep in mind, when Mitt Romney ran for president in 2012, he ran on this idea of restoring a real America. Like, that was sort of the buzzword. That was sort of the slogan, right? He was going to bring us back to a purer, more true America. So there's kind of two questions here. The first is one of state power, right, in general. And then in very in a specific sense, in this sort of form of dictatorship. The second is the content of when they say a real America, what that means, right? So I think very obviously when they're talking about a real America, they're talking about, you know, Truman's America, the late 40s, the early 50s, where, you know, there's kind of this idealization of sort of white society in that period of time. And you see it in shows like Ozzie and Harriet and stuff like that. When in reality, I mean, not only was that sort of life constructed on the back of really, really brutal racial apartheid, but also that vision's fake. It's false. It never occurred. That in fact, in the 1950s, there was rampant alcoholism, domestic abuse, people struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder, so on and so on. It just all got shut away and hidden, but it existed. I mean, you see that in, you know, literature at the time. You know, you see that in Sylvia Plath, for example, like really specifically talking about things like that. So yeah, so you see this very specific vision, but that vision always has been authoritarian, right? There's never been a world in which that vision has not been authoritarian. On some level, that authoritarianism is the authoritarianism of the state, right? That all forms of the state are a structure of imposing will through state violence, right? On a very basic, superficial level. That the state is not like welfare programs and Section 8 and stuff. Like, states exist without that. The state is the police, right? And so every single time that, and police understood in a broad sense, including judges, so on, so on, so on. The military, right? In a broad sense, any vision that you're trying to impose involves using police violence, right? To do that. In the right wing, what has happened though is that, you know, with liberals, they sort of shush that, right? They're like, oh, well, but we're doing good things. So if we're doing good things, it's totally okay for us to use state violence to do good things, right? Which of course is also what the right wing says. With the right wing, they used to do that too. Yeah, we're not really authoritarian. Look, we believe in states' rights and everything, you know, and they kind of shove it off to the side. What is happening now that's really disturbing is that they're not only not doing that anymore, they're openly embracing overt authoritarianism. And in these kind of three different concurrent threads, which are all really dramatically different, exists in sort of different universes from one another that are not always concurrent. But what's fascinating to me is that in different factions of the right wing, you are seeing this drive towards military coups and dictatorship happening simultaneously. And what that tells me is that it is not the specifics of, say, the politics of something like, you know, the Traditionalist Workers' Party or something when that existed. It's actually the roots of all those politics that is at the core of this rise of authoritarianism. That's not just about modern conservatism, but it's actually about conservatism as a political philosophy, as a mentality of statecraft. And then even further, it is an outcome of statecraft, right? It is an outcome of the existence of the state. And so there's a lot of questions that get raised when things like this occur, right? When this kind of support for dictatorship happens, which this, again, not the first time this has happened in America, not the first time that this has even been a publicly articulated politics in America, that actually in the 30s and 40s, there was a relatively significant fascist movement in America called the German American Bund. And there were a few others, the American Nazi Party and things like that. And these were overtly fascist organizations. Also, the Communist Party at the time openly embraced Stalinism, which is a form of authoritarianism. So like, it's not like this is entirely unique. I think what is unique about it though is this sort of, reliance on the idea of the military to be the source through which power is gained by this faction. The military itself has never intervened in politics that way in the United States, unlike in a place like Myanmar, where that happens consistently. And in fact, the country was just run by the military for decades up until very recently, and now is again. There's no real history of that in the U.S. And so we are really dealing with the fever dreams of authoritarian fantasy here. But those fever dreams of authoritarian fantasy have sort of captured 10 to 15% of the American adult population. That's the part that's really upsetting. That if we really look at this, I'm not convinced that this strategy amongst the right wing is going to be successful electorally. It's too alienating. There's too many people that are going to be too determined. As you saw in the last presidential election, there were a lot of people that were really determined to get rid of Donald Trump. And that is going to increasingly become the case with the Republican Party in general, the more that they move in this direction. But that's not the part that's important here. The part that's important here, and this has been pointed out in a number of Washington Post editorials over the last week or so, where one of them was called American democracy is not dead, but we're very much on like going that direction, or something like that, right? And they're all making the same argument I'm making right now, which is that there's a drift towards authoritarianism. Now, for them, they can find that to the political system. I think what's really important is to start to think about what happens outside of that. So we now have, you know, 10, 15, 20% of the American population that is essentially overtly fascist at this point. They won't use that word, but that's not hyperbole. Like, at the point in which you are advocating for a military dictatorship, that is fascism. At the point in which you are arguing that one party should control the leaders of the state permanently, that's authoritarianism, right? That's dictatorship. That's fascist. We have to be very overt about that. Somewhere between 10 and 20% of the American population are overtly fascists at this point. What's upsetting about that is, again, if we look at, and I'm not in any way comparing what's going on here to Germany in the 30s, but this one factoid is relevant. The Nazi Party won 20% of the vote in the election that became the last election before they seized power. They won 20% of the vote. That's it. That's it. That means 80% of Germans were not supporters of the Nazi Party. 80%. That's roughly the sort of breakdown that we're seeing today. Something like 20% of the American population believes in some element of QAnon. There's a significant portion of the American population that believes in dictatorship. There's a rising discourse of a military coup. All of these things are happening simultaneously. None of the, like, a military coup is not going to happen. I just want to be very clear about that. There's literally no universe in which that occurs here. But that doesn't matter. What matters is that there are millions of Americans now who are stuck in a political tendency, which is pushing them farther and farther and farther away from everybody else. That's not just about political dynamics. I mean, that is also what cults do, is they engage in a form of isolationism. The Republican Party has been moving in this direction for a while, ever since the late 80s, mid 90s. But what's happened now is that it is accelerating and it is taking on increasingly absurd sort of features. Because at the end of the day, supporters of the right wing are not supporters of the individual positions. Those don't really matter. They're supporters of the symbolic markers of those positions. They take a certain position on a question. That means that they're a loyal conservative, right? You see this with all number of different things, this kind of conservative culture that has built up. You see this in all number of things. What is happening with that conservative culture, though, is it is already militarized and being pushed further and further and further into a space in which either there's political violence on a mass scale and this attempt to institute dictatorship, or in their eyes, everything is going to collapse. Everyone's going to die. Right. That is literally the narrative that they're building now. They're building a life and death narrative where the only solution becomes dictatorship. That's really upsetting. Not because they're going to get their dictatorship. I don't think there's any world in which that happens, but because a lot of people all around the US, are now convinced that their very existence depends on the Republican Party being able to operate as an authoritarian party within a one-party system, right? Or the military coming in and playing that same role. What that means, though, is, again, the dictatorship isn't going to happen. But for those that believe that that is the only way that they are going to survive, and there are many people that do believe that, that's going to lead to political violence. It just is. There's literally no universe in which you convince a group of people that they're in a life and death situation, and that the only way out is to, you know, murder all of your opponents, and then expect that they're not going to do that. This is kind of, in some ways, we're sort of entering into a world in which the Republican Party is engaging with, you know, what I'll refer to as the Tom Metzger problem. So for those of you that don't know, Tom Metzger, he's dead now, but he was a, longtime neo-Nazi organizer, in California. Very specifically, he was a person who was a major inspiration along with James Mason for the skinhead movement, and groups like the Aryan Nation and with Tom Metzger's White Aryan Resistance, right? Tom Metzger's defense always, so he would use conspiracy theories in the same way with his supporters. He would talk about how if, you know, they didn't destroy all the non-white people, then they were going to die. That was going to be the end of their understanding of life, right? Like, it was all going to be over. And so, of course, neo-Nazi skinheads that believed that murdered people. Totally unsurprisingly. And got into lots of fights with anti-racists, right? I was there to see a lot of those, as were a lot of other people. And those fights were not choreographed. That was not choreography. Like, there were knives pulled. People got really hurt. People died. Two ARA people got murdered in the deserts of Nevada. They got shot in the back of the head by neo-Nazis, right? So, I mean, like, that was the kind of world that existed as a result of that kind of politics. What we're watching now is we are watching that kind of politics of this sort of anxiety about white extinction is just the most logical, the most overt way to put it. But really, that's what's being discussed, what's being worried about is the, you know, it's kind of like a great replacement theory, kind of concurrent to the great replacement theory. It's something that comes out of white nationalism very directly. This idea of a real America and this idea of a real America being a kind of white America and this existential crisis, which you do see features of in, say, the 1960s. And you see features of that with the religious right. But what we're watching now is not a narrative in which they say, if we don't win, eventually everything's going to fall apart. What they're saying now is, if we don't win, we are going to die now. Right? We are going to live in a socialist America now, and all of you are going to go to prison now. That is the narrative that's being put forward. And so when they're convinced that communists control the government, and that they're about to round up all the QAnon people and Trump supporters, and that a military coup is the only solution, when that military coup does not happen, that is when we are going to see the possibility of extreme indiscriminate political violence in certain circumstances. That is the thing that really, really concerns me. And that's the thing that should really be concerning everybody. When it comes to the Republican Party very specifically, they are encouraging this. Right. They are encouraging a reality which places a lot of our safety at risk. Right. I don't think it's life and death right now. But there is definitely a heightened risk in our lives as radicals in the U.S. as a result of conspiracy theories. Right. As a result.
Well, anytime you create a cult around, you know, authoritarian politics and dictatorship, you're asking for mass murder.
Yes, you are. An example of this, there was a group in Germany in the 80s, 90s, into the early 2000s. I think the most recent people from the group got arrested just maybe even a year ago, or 2 years ago, but it was called the National Socialist Underground. And it was a group that grew out of neo-Nazi skinhead movements, but was convinced that, like, they were going to engage in the race war and, like, win their dictatorship. And that did not go the way that they thought it was going to go. And so as a result, a small group of like four or five broke off and started bombing stuff, right? Like, that was their response to this. of them not getting their dictatorship. There's ample examples of things like this in places like Rwanda, or Bosnia, or places like that. But we have to be really overtly clear about this. Like, what is being embraced within the Republican Party? And the dynamics of that embracing are not particularly different from some of the techniques that were used by the Milosevic regime in Serbia in the lead up to the war in Bosnia. One of the things they did pretty consistently, Milosevic very specifically was a sort of mid to high level functionary within the Yugoslav Communist Party, right? And he went to Kosovo because there had been some conflict in Kosovo between ethnic Serbs and Albanians having to do with religion and political power. So generally in Yugoslavia, Milosevic would, you know, someone like Milosevic would show up. There'd be some kind of discussions that would happen. They'd sort of pay lip service to the idea of public feedback and then not do anything and sort of put some troops there to prevent violence and move on, right? That's traditionally the way they did it, because in Yugoslavia, they did not recognize ethnic difference, right? So what Milosevic had to do is he had to create a Serbian identity. And the way he created a Serbian identity was by saying, if you do not, you know, arm yourselves and are willing to fight for, quote, your people, then all these other people are going to destroy you. And what that led Serbians to do and Bosnian Serbs to do was horrendous. Absolutely horrendous. And it's not like there weren't Croatian nationalists doing similar things, because they were being told a very similar narrative that if they don't do those things, if they don't ethnically cleanse parts of Bosnia, then the Serbs are going to come and take over and kill them all. And so what happened in Bosnia was, again, horrendous. 200,000 people were killed. Bosnia is not that big. I think it's like a little bit bigger than Connecticut. It's not large. If you can imagine 220 something thousand people, civilians, getting murdered in Connecticut over the course of 4 years. If you can imagine whole towns being evacuated and all of their residents being put in a prison camp, right? That's what happened there as a result of the exact same political tactics that are being used here. The terms are different. The terms are not ethnic terms. They're not even overtly racial terms, although they're very obviously carrying those connotations with them, right? But the terms have to do with a different existential division around politics, right? That's just the framing. The dynamics of the techniques, though, of creating an immediate existential threat and then encouraging people to organize to defend themselves against that existential threat is the way that you end up with really atrocious neighbor on neighbor warfare like you saw in Bosnia, right? That is not a thing that we want to see here. I've been there. Like I went there in 2003, went to Bosnia for a few weeks, and it was, that was, you know, 4 years after the war had ended. There were still landmines on the sides of the roads. There were still tanks burned out. There were still towns that smelled like firewood because they'd been burned down 3 years before that with all of the residents inside the buildings. I saw those things.
Well, let's also remember that the United States, I mean, we have perhaps an even better example, if we can use that terminology. I mean, we had a section of states leave the Union and start a confederacy because they wanted to continue to use an entire group of people as slaves. And they basically had a revolution in order to continue to do that. And then after that project was defeated militarily, they essentially organized themselves to impose a reign of terror on a variety of levels, whether it was, you know, through groups like white citizen councils or through bands of former Confederate soldiers backed up by wealthy landowners and, you know, organizations like the Ku Klux Klan, you know, instituted a reign of terror to stop the Reconstruction efforts that, you know, were trying to do things like build schools for poor kids and families of different colors, and also, you know, creating the Freedmen's Bureau, allowing people to run for office, redistribute land and so on and so forth, you know, they crushed all that. And then we had the institution of Jim Crow, which lasted for, you know, another 100 years. And now we have, you know, racialized slavery. And we, you know, we continue to see the same thing in different forms. And, I think we should never forget that, you know, I think we forget a lot of times that we have this, you know, white ethno state that comes out of this other, you know, quasi ethno state that we can continue to look back on. And, you know, we can see all the things that they did to ensure that that way of life was going to continue to be cemented. And even if it did change, it would change in such a way that would still benefit them and keep the same things, you know, firmly entrenched. Like when we had the shift from racial slavery, and then we had a system in which people, if they were, caught by the new law enforcement, which was just kind of an updated version of the former slave patrols, that they would be sent to work in prisons in doing work that would benefit the same people that before were running the plantations.
Yeah. And so, I mean, what does this all add up to, right? I mean, we've been talking about this one comment that Michael Flynn made for about an hour now. And what does this all add up to? And I think the takeaways from this whole sort of scenario are the following. And these are very different takeaways than I think kind of the hot takes we've been seeing in the media about this. But the first is that dictatorship is not new to America. There are not only a very long history of authoritarian white supremacy here, right? Meaning the entire history of white people being in North America. And the entire history of this country is a history of brutal authoritarian white supremacy. Not only that, but the idea of advancing or encouraging overtly dictatorship in America is not new. It's something that we have not seen in the present very often until now. But that doesn't mean that the politics of authoritarianism and the politics of dictatorship weren't operative when they were using different terms for them. Right? We have to be very, very clear about that. That what Michael Flynn is talking about here, though he's talking about a military coup, and that is unique, the idea of a group of people having total political dominance is not new to America. The second thing that I think becomes incredibly clear here is some of the racialized elements of what's happening. So when they talk about the real America, when Michael Flynn says we have to save America, we have to save Americans, we have to, like, you know, destroy the liberals who are trying to destroy the country, blah, blah, blah. Really what they're talking about is they're talking about a return to Truman's America. And Truman's America was violently racist, right? That is the world that they're trying to sort of reimagine. And that reimagining, again, attaches itself to this sort of tendency towards authoritarianism. But the third thing, and I think that this is probably the most important, at the end of the day, what Michael Flynn is talking about is statism. He is saying, I want a different group of people in control. That doesn't undermine the fact that the state in itself always, fundamentally, from day one, as a concept, is an inherently authoritarian institution that is grounded in the notion of using police violence to impose people's will on our lives, right? That in itself is not unique to the Republican Party. That is not even unique to conservatives. That is something which is tacitly put forward by every politician, right? That in a lot of ways, we already live in a structure of armed occupation, right? We call those occupiers the police, and they drive around with guns, imposing their will on our lives in the service of political sovereignty, right? Though they don't wear military uniforms, though they're not rounding people up and throwing them in prison camps overtly, they're just using laws as a sort of proxy to do the same thing, right? They're rounding people up and throwing them in prison.
And we should remember, too, that, you know, when Trump was talking about those counties and areas that, you know, where there was rampant voter fraud, I mean, he was talking about largely African-American areas in which people were voting. So, I mean, or, you know, when people on the right talk about Black Lives Matter, which is a, you know, widely popular mass movement that this past summer we saw literally millions and millions of people take part in of different colors. But I mean, especially within the African American community, if we can use that terminology here, you know, it's widely popular. So when people say they want to, like, smash the Marxist-led BLM, I mean, what are they really saying? They're saying we're going to destroy and put down any people of color that get out of line. I mean, you know, this, again, it's the same type of rhetoric.
Yeah, and so on some level, there's this kind of question of statecraft, right? This notion of who's going to run the state, blah, blah, blah. I don't think that this is primarily impactful there. Where it is primarily impactful is everyday life. With the people that have ascribed to this notion, their increased isolation, their increased militancy, their increased sense of immediate danger, those are the things that we both have to pay really careful attention to and also hold the people that are perpetuating that accountable for what they're doing. Because what they are doing right now is in a lot of ways the same thing that every single police chief in every single major city did right about now last year, where they went and did these press conferences where they talked about outside agitators and infiltrators coming in to like cause chaos, blah, blah, blah. Those statements, those lies, those coordinated lies by police chiefs all over the United States was used over and over and over again to justify right-wing violence. Those police chiefs, by saying that in that way, immediately put our lives in danger by lying, by engaging in propaganda. We are watching that happen on a serial level right now. No one got held accountable for that last summer, right? What we have to make sure of is not so much accountability on the level of holding individuals like ethically accountable or something like that. I mean accountability on the, on an organizational level, not on the level of apology, but on the level of dissolution, right? The Republican Party at this point has become a direct threat to our safety. The Democratic Party is too, but in a different way. The Republican Party has increasingly encouraged the development of a culture which leads people to do things like drive cars into protests, which leads people to, like that guy in Texas that got arrested earlier this week, plan to shoot up a Walmart, right? That used to be confined to the alt-right. Right. Like if you remember in Charlottesville, in the lead up to Charlottesville, there were all these stories about Discord channels that got infiltrated and how they were starting to talk. They were like sending memes and telling jokes about hitting people with cars and stuff and how that was confined to the fringe of the right wing. But then as we saw last year, the people that were driving their cars into protests mostly, and there were exceptions, but mostly were not like members of the Klan. Or members of a racist organization. Most of them are just MAGA people, right? So we've already seen some of the results of this. As they increase the heat of this rhetoric, the danger that it poses increases as well. And if we are going to be able to prevent the violence that will result from that, if we're going to be able to defend ourselves, if we're going to be able to prevent the worst outcomes from this, at minimum, the Republican Party needs to be destroyed as an institution. And logically, the entire American political project needs to collapse with it. Because as we said, this is not unique to now, and this is not unique to Republicans. This is something which grows out of statecraft and notions of law and moral superiority, right? Until the mechanisms that allow people to impose their wills on our lives through police violence are destroyed, this is always going to be a problem.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.